Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Chileans in Concepcion plead for water and for police protection.
Ayuda, ayuda, eso necesitamos agua, ayuda. Que venga, venga la policía, seguridad, seguridad.
The earthquake in Chile was 8.8 magnitude. 700 people died. The Haitian earthquake was 7.0 and 230,000 were killed. Two countries, two earthquakes, significantly different results. Why?
Our building standards were strengthened over the past decades, and so you have a population that clearly was very well prepared.
A spokesman from the U.S. State Department, can we learn from Chile? Are we as prepared as they were? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, March 2nd. And good morning, John. You know, the takeaway for me here, thank you very much. The takeaway for me here is that I think there's a lot of things the United States can learn from other countries if we take a look around and maybe are not quite so comfortable in our safety.
Well, they have a long experience in Chile with earthquakes, that's for sure, which brings us right to the top stories we're following this morning. Tens of thousands of people in Concepcion, Chile, are waking up on the streets this morning, days after the seventh largest earthquake ever recorded. The World Health Organization says the death toll will rise as communications improve. More than 700 were killed in the official count by this week's earthquake. Jonathan Franklin is with the Washington Post in Santiago. We spoke to him within the last past half hour.
Sure, there was silence at first, but now what you hear is kind of the roar of a million voices saying, where's the help?
It's expected to begin arriving today, with Argentina and Brazil both sending field hospitals and other supplies. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is bringing 20 satellite phones when she arrives later this morning, the first part of a much larger U.S. aid package.
For the latest this morning, we're joined by Pascal Bonifoy, a correspondent for the Global Post in Santiago, Chile. Pascal, other people are saying Chile was very well prepared for this earthquake. Do the people of Chile feel that they were fully prepared for it?
I think we all felt we were really prepared for it, but events proved it differently.
What do you mean?
Well, if in relation to earthquakes like in Haiti, of course, Chile was much more prepared. But there were major flaws also in the reaction. One was the Navy, which right after the earthquake said there was no risk of tsunami or tidal waves, and in fact, the whole coast was wiped out by tsunamis. And secondly, we're 3 days, this is the fourth day after the earthquake, and the food is just arriving this morning, and not everywhere. The water has been arriving partially. You see the Chilean government sent help to Haiti immediately, but it wasn't able to send help immediately to its own population.
Wow. Yeah, okay. What you were and were not prepared for. Pascal Bonifoy, stay with us. We'll be back with you in a moment.
Here at home, President Obama is expected to explain his revised proposal for passing health care reform overhaul tomorrow. This comes as a survey by the Associated Press suggesting that House Democrats have enough votes to trigger the process called reconciliation to pass the health care bill. The right to bear arms is back before the Supreme Court. The focus now is on the Chicago ban on handguns. Justices struck down a similar ban in Washington, D.C. in 2008. The question is, will they do the same for Chicago?
President Obama is heading to Georgia today. He'll announce plans to offer consumers up to $1,500 for buying insulation, water heaters, or other equipment that helps their homes burn energy more efficiently. $3,000 rebates would be available to anyone who gets a home energy audit and then makes the changes needed to produce an energy savings of 20%. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,403. The S&P at 1,115 and the NASDAQ at 2,273. This morning, we are celebrating the 45th anniversary of the movie Sound of Music by asking, why does that movie endure?
And numbers mean something. 45th anniversary in today's news, the 1,000th American soldier dead in Operation Enduring Freedom. They're all the numbers in the earthquake. Sometimes numbers reveal a lot. Sometimes words are better. We'll have a debate, numbers versus words, a little later on. But what do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Yeah. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
We're following the aftermaths of the 8.8 earthquake that rocked Chile over the weekend, and we've been getting your personal reactions to the disaster.
This is Bill from Oklahoma City. I have worked with Chilean people, including engineers, and have been very impressed with them. Of all the countries in Latin America, Chile is probably the best equipped to handle a crisis like this. Very progressive country.
Obviously, if you have a personal take on the earthquake in Chile, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But we're joined now again by Pascal Bonifoy, correspondent for the Global Post in Chile, who said that Chile in some ways was well prepared and in some ways was not. Pascal, can you give us details on how things stand in Chile right now? Has food and water begun to trickle in?
Was just beginning. The government just sent the first rations and they're being distributed as of today, actually. But we're now into the fourth day. Water has been distributed, but partially it's there's still a lot of need for water and food because people lost everything they had in their homes. Supermarkets have been completely depleted by looting, so really people had nothing to eat. So just now they're starting to receive food.
We heard a lot of reports of what they were calling looting. They instituted some curfews, and there was talk that they might have to institute martial law as well. Is there violence?
Well, there has been quite a bit in Concepcion and in other cities down south. Last night, the curfew was extended. The first night it was between 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Last night it was from 8 p.m. to noon, and people in Concepcion still can't leave their houses until noontime. And apparently, what I've been hearing reports this morning, it's been pretty calm. There's been intense attempts at looting, but it's really subsided in compared to the previous day.
Okay, and what does it look like when you look around? How bad is the devastation? If you see five houses in a row, are two of them gone? Have they mostly stood up?
Down south, you mean, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Santiago's a different story. It depends. I mean, in upper areas, hillsides, and some cities and towns were better, are in better standing because they weren't wiped away by tidal waves.
Right.
Cities, there's construction that's been destroyed, neighborhoods destroyed, but then there have been complete fishing hamlets and coves and small towns that have been completely obliterated by the tidal wave, partially the earthquake and then the tidal wave. And these people are in shelters or up in hills or at relatives' homes. And they've got nothing. They don't even have anywhere to go home to.
Hey, Pascal Bonifoy is a correspondent for the Global Post in Chile. She actually joined us from Santiago. And we're joined now by John Christian. He's an independent consultant, geotechnical and earthquake engineer. John, you've heard a lot of talk about how well-prepared Chile was and that they're used to earthquakes, and so they built to survive this kind of thing. In what ways is that true? How did they build for it?
First place, Chile is a very modern society, and their engineers are very good. They're well known around the world, and what it has to do with the materials you build out of, the kind of structural details you make, how you design the buildings, how you analyze them. There's a whole discipline of designing buildings to behave well during earthquakes.
I knew this well because I grew up in California, and we even were taught in school about rolling buildings, constructing buildings.
That's a retrofit technique, basically. What happens when you have a building like the state capitol that you really don't want to tear down, but on the other hand, it's not really up to date, so you do something to separate it from its foundation.
To make it roll, yeah, so that it doesn't get destroyed. But, you know, we often think in the States that we have the latest in technology in these kind of things, and then we look at Chile and we have to ask ourselves, could we learn something from this other country?
Oh, absolutely. Look, as far as the technical capacity of the country, and particularly in earthquake engineering, I don't think the people in California who are our leaders in this field would think the Chileans ought to take a back seat to them. They recognize them as very, very world-class people. However, in any earthquake, particularly an earthquake of this size, you learn something. Something always goes wrong. And so always you have to go out and find out what went wrong and fix it. That has been one of the strengths of the earthquake engineering field, that they have a long-standing policy dating back, I think, to around 1930s, the Long Beach earthquake, of actually going out and investigating what happened during an earthquake, writing reports on it, and then using that to amend the codes, the policies, procedures, and so forth. And I'm sure this will happen here in Chile.
You know, I myself am not all too badly concerned about California, because this is a place that's been dealing with earthquakes for a very long time. And I can say from personal experience that the people there are not generally going to panic unless it's a, you know, a massive, massive earthquake. But are there other places in the United States that perhaps are not as well prepared for an earthquake?
Yes, there are. Personally, a comment about your situation in California. Everything you just said, you could have said about Chile two or three days ago. If there were a very large earthquake in some part of California, I think you would find in the first couple of days that there would be some things that would not work. I'm not blaming people in California. I'm simply saying that we live in an imperfect world. Now, as to the other places that have a problem, first, the people in the Pacific Northwest, the Oregon, Washington, Seattle area, have over the last maybe decade or two decades discovered that they are exposed to a much higher level of seismic hazard than they had thought they were. And this has had a big impact on their codes, and obviously means that a lot of their stuff is not built to more modern codes. More to the point, I think there are places like Memphis and St. Louis where not only is there historical reason to believe that there could be very large earthquakes, but in many cases, people are actively resistant to doing something about it.
They don't want to tear down the historic buildings?
No, I don't mean tear down the historic buildings. I mean actually improve building codes and things like that.
Because of the cost, perhaps?
Sure.
Okay. John Christian is an independent consultant, a geotechnical engineer, and an earthquake engineer. He joined us from Massachusetts. We also spoke with Pascal Bonifoy, a correspondent for the Global Post in Chile. She joined us from Santiago, Chile, and we will, of course, be bringing you updates from the aftermath of the earthquake in Chile as the morning progresses. And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
Congress apparently isn't through with Toyota. Senate panel takes its turn today, grilling top company officials about the worldwide recall of 8.5 million vehicles. It's the third such congressional hearing in 7 days. Meanwhile, federal documents show that many Toyota Camrys built before 2007 and not covered in the recent recalls also have acceleration problems. President Obama heads to Savannah, Georgia this morning to highlight job creation efforts. It will be the latest stop on what the administration is calling the White House to Main Street tour. While in Georgia, the president will also promote a plan to make homes more energy efficient.
While the president focuses on the economy's health, the First Lady is concerned with the health of America's kids. At an annual meeting of the School Nutrition Association yesterday, she said childhood obesity is everyone's responsibility.
We have to be honest. Our kids didn't do this to themselves. You see, our kids don't decide what to serve or what is sold at lunch.
Those comments by the First Lady come as a new study says U.S. children eat an average of 3 snacks per day. That's on top of 3 regular meals. The researchers say the children are, quote, moving toward constant eating. The findings are published in the journal Health Affairs. Finally, sticking with health news, a new study from Stanford University says cutting salt intake by about 10% could prevent hundreds of thousands of heart attacks and strokes. The researchers say reducing sodium could also save the government close to $32 billion in health care costs. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up,
you're about to enter the exciting world of mobile animated display.
New York Times finance reporter Louise Story talks to us about the dangers posed by an increasingly popular form of advertising, digital billboards.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout is on business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
It turns out that distracted driving is actually a business story. Listen.
You're about to enter the exciting world of mobile animated display. We've taken the concept of billboard advertising and made it come alive with lights and sound and movement. Animated messages move across our mobile billboards in a way that demands attention and promises to change the world of advertising forever.
Great for advertisers, but perhaps not so much for drivers. The series in the New York Times called Driven to Distraction is all talking about the growth of this animated digital advertising on roads across America. What have you found?
So they are growing. Digital billboards, some people are calling them, you know, like internet on a stick. The companies that are the companies that are distributing these, even one of them, Lamar Advertising, that's a huge advertising company, they proudly said, you know, this is like a slide projector. And if you think about it, all day long when we walk around now, we see TV screens everywhere. We see them in the elevators we go. We see them in the shopping malls, the airplanes.
Bus shelters.
Yes, everywhere. But the problem is, alongside the highway, there are some real safety concerns. The Federal Highway Administration is looking at this. They're planning an eye-tracking study for the summer where they're actually going to install cameras in people's cars to see if their eyes stray extra long to look at these digital billboards.
How would they set the standard? I mean, the number there must be a little tough because, I mean, advertisements are supposed to distract you.
That's right. But, you know, since the 60s, if you remember, there were some big beautification efforts of the highway system in the 1960s.
Sure.
They capped the number of billboards at 450,000. And this has been this thing that reigned in advertising. Yes, for decades, you know, advertisers couldn't really up the ante on roadside advertising. And what these digital billboards allow advertisers to do is up the ante. There's about 2,000 of them now. Some people think it may become 10% of the signs on the highway eventually. And each sign can feature ads from, you know, 10 different advertisers, cycle them through the day, show you coffee advertisements in the morning, beer advertisements in the night, you know, and so what they do is it really allows advertising to take the next level. The question is it safe?
They could read your license plate and figure out if you need to pay your credit card bill
and put that on the billboard. Oh, that'd be pleasant, right?
You know, just before you go, Louise, you know, we've been talking about numbers all morning on the program. You do this as a matter of living. You look at numbers on balance sheets and economic statistics, and you have to make those numbers tell a story. How do you do that?
Well, you usually look for numbers to move in a direction. And what's actually been very difficult about this recession is so many different trending statistics haven't trended. You know, the housing numbers keep pointing different ways, bumping up and down, but you look for a trend. The other thing about numbers that kind of fascinates me is I think that in so many ways it's what separates society. I mean, more money you have, that's a number. More IQ you have, that's a number. We looked at percentiles, you know. So numbers actually often divide people. And, you know, when you improve society, it's often when you're moving the numbers around.
Well, numbers divide. Coming together is not a matter of numbers. It's a matter of humanity.
Well, you know, we're going to go to the next person here who also deals with numbers all the time, and that's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And the numbers are definitely trending in favor of UConn. Not that there's any surprise that UConn is doing well at basketball, but the UConn women seem to be, even more so than usual, dominating college basketball for women.
It's true. Last night they beat Notre Dame 76-51 in South Bend to record their 69th win in a row, which means that they are one win away, which should happen this Sunday. They're one win away from tying a record that was set by the UConn women's team in 2001 and 2003 of having the most consecutive victories in women's college basketball.
So this school is about to break their own record.
They are about to. And on the tip of numbers, they're anchored by Tina Charles, who's their all-American, all-everything center. And she last night, not only did they win, but she also passed the leading Nakisha Sales as the storied program's leading scorer with 2,184 points. And she passed Rebecca Lobo as the leading rebounder with 1,273 rebounds. So this is not only is it they're getting consecutive wins, but they're also breaking records along the way.
Now, how are the men's basketball doing? Are they living up to the women?
Well, with UConn?
Yeah, with UConn.
Well, this year is not quite the best year for the UConn men's team, whereas a couple years ago they did a double. They had a dual championship. That's not going to happen this year. The UConn men aren't quite that good.
No. Okay, so who was doing well in men's basketball for college sports?
We touched on it yesterday. Syracuse is the best team in college basketball.
Well, and Kansas is number one, aren't they?
Kansas is not number one anymore. Syracuse has now been.
No,
oh, really?
Ranked.
Oh, they did.
They
oh,
are,
I thought
they
were going to give them the
top
number
rank.
One, even though they lost.
They're in the number one spot.
Wow.
And we were talking, and so the Syracuse is interesting because what they do well is what a lot of teams don't do well. They have a very balanced attack. So they have a very good inside game and an outside game. And they're extremely deep. So they can pull two or three guys from the bench. If you look at their minutes.
Oh, a deep bench.
Exactly.
Right.
So if you look at the minutes that they're playing, they're pretty balanced across the team. So they have about seven or eight guys that play around the same amount of minutes. And all of those seven or eight guys can put up double figures at any given moment. So you never know who's going to really come through on any given day for Syracuse. That's why I like them. They play great defense. They have the 2-3 zone. They're really hard to score on. And they're playing really as a solid unit. So right now, in terms of college basketball, men's college basketball, they're definitely not as dominant as the UConn women. I don't think any team in history will be as dominant as this UConn women's team. But in terms of men's college basketball, this Syracuse team is the most balanced, the most feared team in college basketball.
And they don't have to worry about injuries, right? Because
they have a deep bench.
I sense there's a backstory here with Ibrahim and Syracuse. Is there something going on here? You got a relative that goes to Syracuse?
Well, okay.
Insider information, Hawk.
I'm gushing a little bit because I love the Syracuse Orange, and it's just like when the Yankees won the World Series this past year. It's amazing as a sports commentator to be able to talk about the best team in the land, and they're your favorite team.
All right.
Okay, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway sports contributor, and we are following the numbers not just in sports and money, but all over the place. The 1,000th American soldier has been killed in Operation Enduring Freedom. That's the war in Afghanistan. And 700 killed in the Chilean quake.
That number's
we're talking
rising.
About, yeah, absolutely. And we're talking about the power of numbers. When have numbers meant a lot to you? Not just in news events, but at any time. Let us know at 877-8MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
How old are you? There's a number.
40.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we're exploring numbers in the news. Are they a narrative of reality, or do they distort our picture of what's really going on? Let's check out on some top news stories, and we'll find some numbers right there at 30 minutes after the hour. Let's go to the coastal town of Pelhue in Chile. A resident there said the tsunami on Saturday came in three waves, surging 200 yards into the town. He tells the Associated Press he watched the wave drag away a bus full of tourists who'd hoped to make it to high ground. Rescue officials say only five bodies from the bus have been recovered from the more than 20 believed to be aboard. The death toll in Chile now stands at more than 700 and is expected to rise. In the city of Concepcion, the military curfew has been extended. We spoke to Pascal Bonifoy, a correspondent for Global Post in Santiago, who told us, on top of the lack of basic necessities, the curfew is a growing problem as well.
The first night it was between 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Last night it was from 8 p.m. to noon, and people in Concepcion still can't leave their houses until noontime.
Later this morning, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will arrive in the capital of Santiago.
Back at home, President Obama heads to Georgia later today, where he'll announce plans to pay up to $1,500 to anyone buying equipment to help their homes burn energy more efficiently. $3,000 rebates could also be available to anyone who gets a home energy audit and then makes the changes needed to produce an energy savings of 20%. Meanwhile, a North Carolina school district is reportedly on the verge of repealing desegregation. For the past 10 years, the county has assigned students based on race and socioeconomics, and to ensure balance at each campus. Today, they'll hold a vote on whether or not to overturn that rule. And for better or for worse, Jay Leno back last night.
I'm Jay Leno, your host, at least for a while. So, got to admit, I'm a little bit nervous. Not because it's my first night back, because I know Dave and Oprah are watching.
NBC pulled the plug on Leno's primetime show just before the network began its Olympics coverage. Let's check on the markets. Asian markets mixed. European indices are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,403. The S&P at 1,115. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,273. Those are some of the news stories that we're following.
Numbers, numbers, numbers. You know, there was a time when music was thought to be the dance of numbers. If Greek mathematician Pythagoras had written a symphony, it might have sounded like this modern Pythagoras symphony. Pythagoras, you see, thought that numbers were the tonal units of reality and that music and mathematics were the same. In our time, though, numbers and reality feel interchangeable quite a lot. 10% unemployment, 2% inflation, $1.7 trillion deficit, or the price of oil and pork bellies. That's the din at the pit at the New York Mercantile Exchange, where they trade oil futures, screaming numbers that determine all kinds of things in our reality. Prices of fuel, cost of medicines, chemicals, foods. Perhaps Pythagoras would think of that noise in this way.
Cotton, up 45, 80. Cotton, up 45, 90.
Orange. That's a piece by audio artist Ben Rubin. It's his sound portrait of how trading numbers interact with music and reality in a more artistic way. Are numbers as useful as they are pretty? Well, let's find out, and let's have a bit of a debate. With us, with differing views of how numbers communicate to all of us, are James Geary, a journalist and the author of Geary's Guide to the World's Greatest Aphorists. James Geary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, John. Glad to be here.
And Kaiser Fung is the author of Numbers Rule Your World. He's in the studio. Kaiser, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So we have varying views here. Do numbers distort or give us a sense of the scale of reality? Are they a help or a hindrance? Do you prefer numbers, Kaiser Fung?
Well, as the title of my book implies, I certainly think numbers have a very powerful way of conveying information. But it's not all numbers. It's picking the right numbers and providing the context for people to interpret the numbers.
James Geary, words are better?
Well, yes, as an author and a journalist, I would say words are better. I think numbers are important, and I think especially today when some of the biggest issues facing us involve numbers, you know, the financial crisis, global warming, all those kind of things involve science and numbers, and that's crucial. But I don't think science touches the experience of people when they're dealing with these issues. For example, I used to live in Amsterdam, and I lived right around the corner from the Anne Frank House. And when you talk to people about the Holocaust, you can name some horrific numbers, the number of people who were murdered, for example. But going to that house, reading her diaries, seeing the little secret passageway that led to the rooms where she and her family were hiding, no number can replace that. And it's only by really confronting the words and the words that speak to that experience that you really feel the impact of that whole event.
Well, James Geary, that's one for you. Kaiser Fung, how does a number of the scale of, say, 6 million, we're referring to the Holocaust there, or 1.6 trillion in the case of the deficit, get infused with a human story that causes the number to resonate in a more human way? We've talked about the earthquake this morning. We're talking about the 1,000 dead in Afghanistan, the Operation Enduring Freedom.
Right. So I think the a good example is if you think about the deficit, and we these days are talking about the trillions and trillions of dollars. In 2008, James Fallows at The Atlantic actually wrote an article called the $1.4 trillion question about, you know, how the Chinese government is funding our debt. Now, it turns out that the online readers really loved this article and spread it around, but actually with a very different title. It was called Average American Owes Average Chinese $4,000.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and you could tell if you pick the right numbers, it makes a big difference.
James Geary, let me take it back to you. I heard a number over the weekend that was pretty interesting. If you take, and this is more geometry rather than specific algebraic numbers, if you take the Earth and make it the size of a basketball, okay?
Okay, I'm following you so far.
And you suck all the water off the earth, it'll fit into a ping pong ball, okay?
Uh-huh.
And if you take the fresh water that's available on the earth, it fits on the head of a pin by that scale. Does that use of numbers give you a sense of how much fresh water we have on earth?
Yeah, but you've also completely lost me as well. I think those kind of analogies are useful, but I think as the previous speaker just said, for me, personalization is the key. So when you name a sort of big generic number like the total national debt, well, that really doesn't. I can't see. It's not immediately obvious how that affects me. But when you say I owe the average Chinese person $4,000, well, then I can understand what you're talking about, because then it's a personal story. It applies directly to my life. And I think especially with money, you know, not just the global financial crisis, but the personal financial crisis. If you say to somebody, if you don't save enough for retirement in 30 years, you're going to be really, really in a difficult situation. Well, that's one thing. But if you give them an example of someone who hasn't saved and who is in a really difficult situation, then the message gets home in a much more powerful way than if it was just a number.
It's the Aesop grasshopper and the ant story, right? Here's a response that we got. What's the importance of numbers? Are they more important than words? Here's one of our listeners.
Hi, this is Jim Barkley in Medford, Massachusetts. Numbers and words are equally important. As Norton Juster said in the Phantom Toll Booth, the kingdom of words and the kingdom of numbers had to learn to get along because
you couldn't have tea for two without the tea, could you?
But you wouldn't have tea for two without the two, could you?
So, James Geary, we make it a tie here.
I could live with that.
Kaiser Fung, do you think people who use numbers a lot need to maybe use words to do what the title changer in James Fallow's article did to humanize the issue of the deficit?
Absolutely. I think one of the reviewers of my book actually pointed this out, is that for a book that's called Numbers Real World, there are actually very few numbers, surprisingly, in the book. And that's because I needed to provide the context behind it.
All right. Numbers and words, that's our focus in this segment. Thanks to Kaiser Fung, author of Numbers Rule Your World, and James Geary, journalist, author of Geary's Guide to the World's Greatest Aphorist, joined us from London. James and Kaiser, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oh, man. That sounds
nice.
Great, but it's a little early for spring, sadly. If it were springtime, our listener responses theme might be, based on a conversation we had yesterday on the program, it's called Returning to the Nest.
My name is Emily Sustin. I'm 30 years old, and I'm living with my parents, too, on Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
And we talked yesterday about the trend of adult children, you see, moving back with their parents. The AARP reports that about one-third of all 18 to 49-year-olds live at home. And we heard a bunch of stories like Emily's.
I'm a journalism student. I'm still finishing my master's, trying to do it long distance. And I'm living with my parents. And it's even worse than the woman who was on the air, because Cape Cod is mostly a retirement community, but they're very nice.
This is Julie from Norman, Oklahoma. I have a slightly different situation with my family. Both my mother and my mother-in-law moved in with me over the last 2 months. So it's two grandmas, my three-year-old daughter, and my husband and I in a three-bedroom house with one bathroom. And when you add in the younger sister-in-law of mine, the talk becomes even more complicated in terms of the division of labor. 17-year-olds don't seem to be very interested in contributing to the household. Otherwise, it's been a great experience, and I recommend intergenerational living to everyone.
Talk about numbers. Three-year-old daughter, husband, and I in a three-bedroom house with
one bathroom.
One bathroom.
That's the number that shocked me.
Barb in Denver posts to our site, thetakeaway.org, this story. My parents made it clear that I could always return home if needed. I left home for college at 17 and returned for 2 months while looking for housing at age 27. It was such a gift. It allowed me to take some risks so I could follow my dreams.
But moving back in, not always that great. Laura also posted to the site, thetakeaway.org. My sister and her husband recently welcomed their unemployed adult child back into their home, and it's been a very difficult process for all of them. I don't see a single advantage beyond the obvious, a parent's feeling of responsibility to provide housing for a child in need, no matter what the age. My sister spent her life being a daughter, sister, mother, wife, with all the responsibilities. When her offspring flew from the nest and it was at last empty, she began to enjoy being somewhat independent, but in taking her adult child back into her home, she has once again assumed the mommy role.
Extended family, extended headache. But there is some advice we got for people like Laura's sister.
This is Alan in Somers. The secret to having a young person back in the house is not to make it a parent-child relationship, but to make it a landlord-tenant relationship. That allows the child not to feel infantilized, and it allows the parents to not feel that supportive.
You know how to reach us at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And let's move on to a different kind of nest last night.
Good to be home, Kev. I'm Jay Leno, your host, at least for a while. So actually, we were off for the last couple
John.
Of weeks. Kind of like the Russians at the Olympics. Whoa, what happened to them? Yeah.
Jay's first night back at the Tonight Show. I know John Hockenberry was watching closely. He did get a warm welcome back from our listeners. Or maybe you were holding out, though, for Conan.
Hey, this is Matt from Myrtle's Inlet, South Carolina, and I'm voting for Conan O'Brien.
Definitely Conan O'Brien. Clever, witty, wonderful. Jay Leno, average, common, trite.
Takeaway listeners are with Coco.
That's the demo we want, babe. I'm telling you. Go with Coco.
I like Jay Leno.
We wish him well.
I like him.
We wish him well. Reach us at 877-8MYTAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here again with John Hockenberry, and we're talking about numbers all this morning, and here's a couple numbers.
You are 16, going on 17, baby.
That's right. It's big numbers, 16 and 17. Everyone recognizes that music, right? That's the sound of the music. It's the 45th anniversary of that film, and we're going to talk to a couple people. The voice that you're hearing right now, that's Daniel Truitt, who played Rolf, Liesl's boyfriend, and we're also going to talk with the grandson of the real Maria von Trapp in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Along Chile's coast, the destruction is widespread following Saturday's earthquake. The country's president says authorities are flying tons of food, water, and other basics into the area. And a curfew in the city of Concepcion, which was badly affected by the quake, will remain in effect until midday today, part of an effort to crack down on security problems there. As for Americans in the country, State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley gave the latest.
We have accounted for all of our embassy personnel, and we are not aware of any American casualties.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is expected to arrive in the Capitol this morning. She's bringing satellite phones to help restore communications.
Voters in Texas head to the polls today to vote in a primary election for governor, which will probably be decisive. The Republican contest is heated. It's, in a sense, a battle of the incumbents. Incumbent Governor Rick Perry trying to fend off a challenge by Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison. Joining us now is Ben Philpott. He's covering the race for KUT News and the Texas Tribune. Welcome, Ben.
Good morning.
So what do you think the vulnerability of Rick Perry, the incumbent governor, is right now to Kay Bailey Hutchison, who has to be an establishment politician if there ever was one?
Well, you know, you would think that Governor Perry only received about 39% of the vote in the last gubernatorial election in 2006. So, you know, plenty of the state was not in, over 60% of the state was not interested in voting for him then. Now, however, you know, it's the Republican primary, and he made a great strategic move back in last April. He went to one of the first Tea Party rallies held in the country that was held in Austin and kind of got out in front of that movement and got the people who would normally be maybe anti-incumbent voters, and he has 10 years in office as governor, to be on his side. So that's kind of taken any steam out of any kind of change message that Senator Hutchison's been able to deliver.
Well, Ben, as you know, one of the reasons why Texas politics is so interesting is that it is so unusual and not translatable necessarily to the rest of the country. Do you think his Tea Party creds are a sign of a trend more broadly in the national electorate?
You know, we're not even sure exactly how much of a trend it is in Texas. We talk about it every week. We have an actual quote-unquote Tea Party candidate also running in the Republican primary, Deborah Medina. She has reached as high as the low 20s in polling, almost, you know, leapfrogging Senator Hutchison, whose numbers have been not very good so far. But, you know, what will happen on Election Day, we're really all interested in seeing whether or not there is maybe a 20-25% Tea Party vote within the Republican primary.
Turnout expected quickly?
Not a whole lot. Double what it was in 2006, but he didn't have a Republican primary opponent then.
All right, Ben Philpott, reporter covering the race for KUT News and the Texas Tribune. In other news, President Obama heads to Savannah, Georgia this morning to highlight job creation efforts, the latest stop on what he calls his White House to Main Street tour. While there, the president will promote a plan to make homes more energy efficient. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's been 45 years since Julie Andrews first spun in her dress and apron around the hills of Austria.
You can
singing
still see the grass.
Absolutely. Everybody remembers that. And people forget oftentimes what a huge success that movie was. It won 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. And adjusted for inflation, get this, The Sound of Music, adjusted for inflation, earned more than $1 billion
at
the box office.
Not a single avatar in the movie. Not one computer-generated effect.
Not one thing. Here to talk about the enduring appeal of this movie, The Sound of Music, two people whose lives were profoundly affected by it. Sam Von Trapp is a grandson of the real-life Maria Von Trapp, and he also runs the Trapp Family Lodge alongside his father and sister that's in Vermont. And we're also joined by Dan O'Truitt, who sang and danced as Liesl Von Trapp's Nazi turncoat boyfriend, Rolf. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Sam, let's start with you. That was your grandmother that was portrayed by Julie Andrews in the film, and I have to ask you, how were the characterizations? Was that really what your grandmother was like and your grandfather as well?
Yeah, that was probably what she was like on a good day. You know, it's it's always interesting when one writes one's own story. The movie The Sound of Music and the stage play were based upon my grandmother's book called The Story of the Trapp Family Singers. So, of course, it tells her version of it. And she was a very strong person. So my Aunt Maria, who was the actual real reason that my grandmother Maria came to stay with the family, my Aunt Maria had been sick and was not able to walk to and from school every day. So my grandmother Maria actually came just to be her tutor. But she said that my grandmother was extremely fun. Well, in the beginning, and later on, she became a pretty strong matriarch who really held the family together.
I've heard that the family calls her the tyrannical saint.
Well, that was actually a joke. That actually came from Theodore Bekel, who played my grandfather on Broadway, and he came to know my grandmother a little bit. But the issue that many of my aunts have is really with the portrayal of my grandfather, that he was actually much kinder than that in real life and much more gentle father.
Well, there's a couple changes, actually, in the movie, and I want to turn to you, Daniel Truitt. You played Rolf in the movie, and, of course, in the film, Rolf turns the Von Trapps into the Nazis. In the original Broadway show, Rolf doesn't do that. I'm wondering how you felt about that change.
Well, the main reason I got the role was the first thing I had to do was the last scene in the picture, because part of the problem they'd had with The Sound of Music, including certain directors, was that they thought it was a little saccharine sweet. So they had Ernest Lehman, the Academy Award-winning screenwriter, redo this, and they went to the character of Rolf because they wanted to bring in more the reality of the tragedy of what children went through and the indoctrination that would make them do such a thing as this, because they felt the film needed more of that realistic part. So, yes, they did redo it from the original play, and that's the first scene I had to shoot in the picture, actually, was the crypt scene to make sure that it was going to work and it was believable, and because I was the actual last person cast in the film, so it was very important for me in that character. So even though I was the turncoat bad guy, that's the reason I got the role, so I really can't complain, although I would prefer that people would think more of Rolf and Liesl in the gazebo.
Well, but we shouldn't gloss over this. This was Hollywood's first touch of the Holocaust, really, 45 years ago after World War II. It was a very sensitive, difficult subject.
Well, absolutely, and you know, I think that that's what the Sound of Music was trying to portray a little bit more, to give it more of the strength and not just be so, you know, just songs, which were wonderful, but at least it did at least give the reality of the tragedy of the Holocaust and the tragedy to both Americans, people fighting, as well as the German people, how they all suffered over this horrible movement of supremacy and indoctrination, which it was. But to take a musical like Richard Rodgers and Hammerstein did is truly incredible that it was that successful, and it's like no other. It's played on television 3 times a year and has endured. I still get the fan mail from all over the world, and no film has had the impact that this one has.
Well, Sam, I'm interested in wondering what kind of impact it's had on your life as the grandson of Maria Von Trapp, and I'm wondering how present was this film and this story in your life as you were growing up?
You know, it's interesting. As a kid, I did watch it, and my parents tell me that I liked it very much. But then we really kept it at arm's length. And in our family, I think there was a real quest within all of my relatives to try to stay grounded and stay humble. And I think that they felt that if they were to really acknowledge and accept that this movie about our family was that popular, and if they were to actually accept that they were famous, I think they thought they might lose touch of some of those basic values. I really didn't see it again until I was 23, actually. So people would ask me questions like, did the nuns really steal the spark plugs? And I would look at them and say, what are you talking about? So I finally got it all figured out when I was 23. I was living in Mexico and studying Spanish with a family down there, and I watched it in Spanish.
Was there any one thing in the film that bothered either your grandfather or grandmother where they said, well, that was not right?
No, I think the only issue was really just, you know, there were some small changes, but the structure is there. As I said, my aunts were a little bit disappointed that my grandfather seemed so stern. But what I think is most important is that the integrity and the principles come through, and the fact that my family were able to stand up to the Nazis, and not everyone was in a position to do that.
Okay, Sam von Trapp, grandson of the real-life Maria von Trapp. He runs the Trapp Family Lodge in Vermont, and Daniel Truett played Rolf, Liesel's boyfriend, in The Sound of Music.
Happy 45th birthday. We're continuing our celebration with a playlist of a few of our favorite Sound of Music covers, remixes, and musical nods to the Rodgers and Hammerstein classic. We've got everyone from John Coltrane to Gwen Stefani to Kenny G to LL Cool J.
LL's the most rugged, God and no man's above it. Gotta love it. Yo! Get this bread, use the infrared. The industry, it's all about me. You ain't going...
Bah, yes, indeed. Climb every mountain there, LL Cool J. Even Stewie from Family Guy. You can check it out at takeaway.org in our blog section. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.